And well, I'll go through at least two of them in detail. The second one, I'll just say in words what the essence of the theorem is. And for the third law, I don't think I'll do, I won't say very much about it. But anyway, I just want to go through some of that. And so what we're going to be dealing with here is, the kind of black hole that we've been talking about this morning, the ones that are not necessarily Kerr, because the space-time outside the black hole may not be empty. There might be a distribution of matter there, which prevents the black hole from being a Kerr black hole. But we'll be dealing, for the most part, with stationary black holes. And stationary black holes, therefore, have this Killing vector, which is, a combination of time-like plus the axisymmetric Killing vector. So we do have, a stationary black hole and an axisymmetric black hole, which is not necessarily Kerr. So we're going to be dealing with the behavior of the event horizon. So let me draw a piece of the event horizon. And the horizon is going to be generated by null geodesics, which wrap around the event horizon as they move around in the phi direction. So those are the generators. And here we're going to do, remember what we used to do with null hypersurfaces and, null hypersurfaces with generators on them. We're going to introduce a coordinate system that's going to be adapted to the behavior of the generators, a coordinate system on the event horizon of the black hole. And I've already introduced the V parameter, which runs along the generators. And what I'm going to do is to use two angular coordinates to label the generators, and much along the same way that we used to do when we were talking about null hypersurfaces. So we have a coordinate system on the horizon. Which is, the parameter V and the generator labels theta A. And, of course, we know that the induced metric on the event horizon itself is a null hypersurface. It's topologically three-dimensional, but metrically it's two-dimensional because there is no displacement along the null directions. So we have an induced metric which is two-dimensional. And sigma is the notation that I've used before for the induced metric. We have a vector C, which is tangent to the null generators. We've talked about that before. And we're going to have, this is the tangent vector, which is also the normal to the hypersurface. And we have the other two tangent vectors, which describe displacements across generators. So xi is what happens to, is what you get after differentiating the coordinates with respect to the parameter, leaving the generator labels constant. And the other tangent vectors are obtained by differentiating the coordinates with respect to the generator labels, keeping the parameter v fixed. So all of that is familiar from what we used to do when we studied null hypersurfaces. Those vectors are orthogonal, and I can complete the basis by introducing another null vector, which is going to be pointing, not in the same direction as xi, but in the, so to speak, orthogonal direction. That's the capital N vector, which is also familiar. And so to complete the basis, we're going to add N alpha to that. And alpha is going to be normalized in such a way that, it's a null vector, and it's normalized with xi through this condition right here. So xi here is playing the role that k used to play in our former discussion, and then v, of course, is the parameter, and I'm using v instead of lambda. When we evaluate the four-dimensional metric on the event horizon, we have completeness relations that say that the metric can be decomposed into the two null directions. And the purely transverse directions that are described by the vectors E. And another thing that I can write down is an expression for the surface element on the event horizon. We're talking here about a null surface, obviously, And, you know, we can go back to our notes and figure out what the, you know, what this, the vectorial surface element is on an all-hypersurface. And you'll remember that there was a minus sign that was sort of inherited from the way we've defined these things to begin with. But essentially, the surface element points in the normal direction. The normal direction is the direction of the vector c. Again, we have this sort of strange behavior that, you know, the normal is also a tangent vector. So it's in the direction of c, and it involves the two-dimensional surface area that's defined in terms of this metric and a displacement along the generators. So that's the sort of thing that we had before, and ds is just the, you know, the two-dimensional line element, the two-dimensional area element that we get using the induced two-dimensional metric on the event horizon. So, okay, so all of that is something that we've learned about before. So now's the time where we actually incorporate this into our discussion of black holes. And the other thing that I'm going to need is something that I talked about this morning, and that's the Rachaud-Urie equation. So another equation that I'll involve in what we're doing is the generalized form of Rachaud-Urie's equation, which says that the expansion is changing according to that equation here. And we have the shear, and we have the Ricci term, which has been replaced by an energy momentum tensor by using the field equations. And so theta is the rate of expansion of the congruence of null generators on the event horizon. And that's, you know, very directly related to the element of surface area that's carried along by the generators. So you remember that the expansion in the null case is defined as a fractional rate of change of cross-sectional area, not volume. So essentially, what we have is that the expansion really is the v derivative, fractional v derivative of an element ds of cross-sectional area. This surface area right here, this you know, this surface element really is an element of cross-sectional area as I follow the motion of the generators. So all of that is stuff that we directly import from our previous discussion of non-hypersurfaces, and this will go into the derivation of the laws of black hole mechanics. So I kind of like this lecture, and I wish I'd had more time to do it a little bit more slowly, because this is where it all comes together. I mean, all of the stuff that we've learned over the semester, going from congruences to hypersurfaces to, you know, notions of mass and angular momentum, it will all come together in this lecture. We're going to put everything together and see what comes out. Okay. So the laws of black hole mechanics start at zero, and they're numbered like the laws of thermodynamics, and it's not, you know, it's not an accident. So we're going to start with the zeroth law. And the statement of the zeroth law is that the surface gravity kappa, which I should have defined somewhere around here, we know that c is a Killing vector, so I'll write it out here. And we know that c satisfies the Judy-Zeck equation in affine parameter form, in non-affine parameter form. And this is the equation that defines the surface gravity kappa. And the statement of the zeroth law is to say that kappa is a constant over the entire event horizon. So part of this statement is not remarkable, but part of this statement is remarkable. What is not remarkable is the fact that kappa should be constant as you move along the generators. The generators define a Killing symmetry. And basically, nothing should change along the orbit of a Killing symmetry. So as you move along the generators, you know, the induced metric on the horizon the surface gravity of the generators, all of those properties that you assign to the event horizon will not change because we do have a Killing symmetry. So that kappa should be constant along the generator is certainly not a surprise, and we'll prove this, but you know, it's something that should be expected. There's really no, no surprise about that. The surprise has to do with the fact that as we go from one generator to another generator, that kappa should retain the same value. So it's really motion across generators, and the fact that motion across generators does not produce a change in kappa, that's something that's not expected. That's something that is, you know, is a surprise and something that requires a fairly, you know, fairly detailed proof. We had that property for Kerr. We're going to try to show this more generally for this, you know, more general context of stationary axisymmetric black holes. The proof is a bit lengthy, surprisingly lengthy for, you know, something that can be stated so easily. It requires a few, quite a few steps. In the book, I do it two ways. I do it in the text through a very, very clever argument, which is way too clever for its own good. It requires the existence of a bifurcation two-sphere, and you may or may not be happy with this argument. I also provide a different derivation as an exercise at the back of the book, and that's the one I'll go through here in class. That argument is more nuts and bolts. I think it's more revealing in terms of what's really going on. But it's not very clever, it's pretty brute force, but it produces the result. Okay. So how do we go about proving this? Well, there's really two parts of the proof, two parts of the statement. One is that we need to prove that changing kappa, you know, as we move along generators, so that the change of kappa as we follow the motion of the generators is zero. We need to prove this, and we also need to prove the other statement, which is the hard one. Let's say that as we move from generator to generator, kappa also doesn't change. That's the hard one to prove. The first one is quite easy to prove. Okay, so I need to prepare the way to get that, but we need to, you know, we'll need to prove all of that here. Okay, so how do we prove this? Well, let me first, you know, set the stage. And the first thing that I'll need to do is to come up with a decomposition of this quantity on the event horizon. And what I mean by that is that while we have a basis that's provided here, I want to decompose that tensor according to the vector basis that we have at our disposal. So what I mean by that is that in general, I could express any tensor, and in particular this one, in terms of all of its, you know, explicit components along all of the vectorial directions in the basis. So what I mean is that, well, I will have a component along xi and xi. I will have a component along xi and n, and then I will have a component along xi and e. I need this here. I'm sorry if I'm messing up the indices. Okay, I'll do it like that. And then I just keep going and make sure that I list all possible components. So then I have, you know, components along n and xi. I have components along n and n. And then I have components along n and e. So I have all of that stuff. And finally, I have the remaining components. I have components along e and xi. I have components along e and n. And finally, I have components along E and E. Could I ask someone a favor and go get me some chalk? All I have are, you know, little bits and pieces, and I won't survive that. Would you mind? Yeah, thank you. Okay, so essentially, so those are all the components that I can have. And if you count them, you'll find that, okay, here I haven't imposed any, you know, restrictions on what this is. We'll start doing that and kill most of those components. But essentially what I'm constructing here is a 4x4 matrix. And, you know, if you count the number of components here, I have 16, the appropriate number. I have 1, 2, I have 2 here, so that's 4, 5, 6, 2 more, 8, 2 more, 10, 2 more, 12, and here I have a 2x2 matrix, 4, is that 16? Good. So I have the requisite number of components. But in fact, you know, this is just not an ordinary tensor. This tensor has a lot of, you know, properties. You know, the fact that it satisfies the geodesic equation, the fact that it's a Killing vector, and the fact that it's null. So we're going to use all of those properties, and we're going to see that, in fact, we'll get rid of most of those components. So the first property that I can use is the fact that C is null. And what this means in particular is that, well, if I differentiate, well, if I multiply this equation by C alpha, and I make sure that I evaluate this only in directions that are tangent to the hypersurface. So I can get, so C is null on the hypersurface, not off the hypersurface, which means that what I have is a statement that, so what I do here is to say that C times C is 0, therefore I can differentiate it. And if I differentiate along the direction of C, well, the norm of C is going to be 0 as I move along the generator, and therefore that derivative is 0. And another derivative that is 0 is the one where I differentiate still on the hypersurface in the direction of the transverse vectors. So again, the idea here is that this is the same thing as half the derivative of C times C, and I differentiate that and I stay on the hypersurface. Because the vector is the vector field is null everywhere on the hypersurface, I get something. I get 0. What I could not write is the equation that say that the derivative in the direction of n is 0, because that means differentiating away from the hypersurface, and C is not going to stay null if I go away from the hypersurface. So I have access to those two equations from the null condition. And, well, what we have to do is to look at our decomposition and keep all the terms that survive when we take the Xi and Xi component to that. And, well, Xi is orthogonal to itself, so we kill that term. Xi is orthogonal to itself, we kill that term. This term, but we retain that one. So Xi times n is minus 1, we get 2 factors here. So we get, you know, we get an E from that term. And is that the only thing that remains? Yeah, I think it's the only thing that remains. So that means that E is 0, and we kill that term over here. From over here, well, we're going to kill all the terms that go away when we multiply on the left by C alpha. So we get rid of this, we get rid of that, get rid of this. And we multiply also with the transverse vector on the right, so we get rid of that because E is orthogonal to Xi. So what do we pick up? I think we pick up a term from here. We have Xi multiplying N from over here, and we have E multiplying E from over there. So what we pick up from that is a minus sign. We pick up FA, and then we get the inner product. Sorry, I should have called this B. Just to be sure, we get FA, and then we get the inner product of EA with EB, which is sigma AB. Sigma EB is not 0. It's a two-dimensional metric that can be inverted. And what that means is that both E and FA are killed off by this requirement. So we kill that term, and we kill this term over here. So we can keep going like this because we're not done. And by the time we're done, well, a lot of the terms will have been killed off. Thank you for the talk. So the second requirement that I can incorporate is that Xi satisfies the geodesic equation. So when I evaluate the left-hand side with all the terms that are still here, so going up there, so I kill the first term, but I keep I have something from the second term, so I get minus b xi alpha, and xi times n give me minus one, so it's that minus sign over here. Then I get nothing from over here. I get nothing from over here. I get nothing from here. Nothing from here. And I suppose I have one last term coming from here. So I get that. And I get minus HA EA alpha. And, well, it's pretty clear that if this result is to agree with that one, I have to assign the right value for B, which is going to be minus kappa. And I have to kill off HA because it doesn't belong here. So, so the conclusion from this is that B is now identified with kappa, and HA is zero. So we've killed this, and we replace that by minus kappa. OK, well, we keep going. We have a few more properties to work with. OK, I'll use this one first. So here I'm dealing with a stationary event horizon. And as we said this morning, if the expansion is to be zero, we need two conditions. We need for the shear to vanish, and we need that to vanish as well separately. And there we invoke the null energy condition. So leaving that alone for the time being, although I'll come back to that, what we have is the property is a congruence that is such that the expansion, the shear, and the rotation tensor all vanish, right? And this morning you were suggesting that this is something that follows immediately from Killing's equation, but I'm going to suggest here that it's not so. It's a separate, you know, you have to, they give you separate conditions. So the next condition I want to impose is the fact that the expansion, the shear, and the rotation of the congruence all vanish. And what we have to remember is the relationship between these quantities, these congruence quantities, and the gradient of the tangent vector field. And if you remember, these quantities here are all the irreducible pieces of this guy projected down into the transverse directions. Remember? Let's say yes. So what the expansion, shear, and rotation tensor refer to are the purely transverse pieces of that tensor right here. And the purely transverse pieces of these guys, the purely transverse piece of this is that. And what that means is that I have to kill off all of this to kill off you know, the transverse, the transverse piece of this, and therefore, if it's true that the expansion, shear, and rotation tensors are all zero, it's going to be true that this term right here is zero. There cannot be a transverse part to that tensor right here. So next I'm going to do Killing's equation, and what Killing's equation tells me is that, well, this tensor has to be antisymmetric. Killing's equation would tell me, if I didn't incorporate the condition I just did, Killing's equation would have to tell me that this is antisymmetric. But it doesn't tell me that all of that has to be zero. That comes from the shear tensor. Oh, wait up. I think I'm now agreeing with you, because Killing's equation tells us that this is antisymmetric. And therefore, if this is antisymmetric, it cannot have a symmetric tertiary part. And that's the statement that the shear must vanish. Okay, so if I proceeded in the opposite order, and I, if I were to do what I'm going to do next before what I just did, I would say let's impose that this, this be a killing cancer, that C be a killing vector, then that would tell me that this tensor is antisymmetric, therefore this tensor is antisymmetric, and that would correspond to the statement that the shear and the expansion have to be zero. So it does follow from Killing's equation. So thank you. Okay, so expansion, shear, and rotation vanish, and that means that J AB vanishes. So I've said that before. And then, well, the final condition that I'll use is the one that say that C is a killing vector. And what that means is that, well, the anti, the symmetric part of this derivative must vanish. And while I look at what's left over, and I just have to be sure that what's left over is properly antisymmetric. And well, this is fully symmetric, so I'll have to get rid of that. Is there anything left that's fully symmetric? No. So what I'm going to have to do here is to make sure that this combines properly with that, and we'll identify D as the surface gravity, and this will combine with that in the appropriately antisymmetric combination. So, so what we get from that then is the statement that C alpha comma beta, after killing everything that needs to be killed, is, so we get the statement that we get a minus kappa like this in the antisymmetric combination. So that's kappa and the D term now coming together. And then there's one leftover quantity, which is CA, and that involves CEAB in the same antisymmetric combination. So after imposing all the conditions that C needs to satisfy on the event horizon, we find that our decomposition, you know, is simply this one. So only three independent quantities, kappa being one of them, and those you know, refer to direction, you know, directional derivatives that are not in the direction of the generators, but in the cross, you know, cross-sectional transverse directions. Okay. Well, I think that was informative. So that's, you know, that's a good starting point to do what we wanted to do. I can isolate kappa because I'm going to need to manipulate kappa by taking the, where's my equation, my geodesic equation. If I multiply this equation by n alpha, I'm going to generate a minus one on the right-hand side, and I can solve for kappa that way. So my starting expression for kappa that will then be differentiated is the one that say that we're talking about this component of that tensor field, and that's something I could have read off directly from that equation anyway, just solving for kappa by multiplying on the right by the appropriate set of basis vectors. So we have that, and I could write down an expression for C as well. I don't think I'll need that, so I'll just leave that alone for the time being. Okay. Okay. So now I can get started. So I'll need this later on for site calculations. This is the expression for kappa that I'll differentiate in the two directions, either the V direction or in the theta direction, to try and prove that the right-hand side is zero. So let's get started with that. Okay, the first derivative, where we differentiate along the generators, Well, that's just the derivative of kappa in the direction of xi. And I have an expression over there for kappa, so all I have to do is to differentiate it. And when I differentiate it, well, I get minus the derivative of the Killing vector field. Then I leave n and xi alone. And then I have the extra pieces where I differentiate n and leave xi alone. And then I have the final term where I leave n alone and I differentiate xi. And all of that is multiplied by xi. Remember that? I think in the first homework problem, you had to evaluate the second derivative of an arbitrary Killing vector, and you discovered that this was given in terms of the curvature tensor. So I'm going to use this result here. This term right there, the first term, is actually equal to plus r alpha beta mu nu dotted with nu, xi nu. And that multiplies n alpha xi beta. The second term is this derivative of xi and this derivative of n. Sorry, I forgot the xi mu here. And then the last term is all of that. Okay. Well, the first term goes away, right? Because this is antisymmetric in mu and nu. This is symmetric in mu and nu. And therefore, we get zero. The other two terms will cancel out, as we're going to see in just a sec. So what I can do here, is that what I wanted to do? Oh, I know. Okay, so this is given by kappa xi alpha. And same thing here. This is kappa xi beta. So let me rewrite this. We get minus kappa xi alpha n alpha differentiated with respect to mu. And the other term is minus kappa. And there we get xi alpha comma beta, xi beta, times n alpha. So here we get another kappa and another xi. And over here, what I'll do is to transfer the derivatives from n to xi, because the inner product between xi and n is equal to a constant, is equal to minus 1. So this can be expressed as xi differentiated with respect to mu, multiplying n, multiplying mu. And well, there we get another kappa. We keep the minus sign, which is going to cancel out this minus sign. And we have minus kappa xi times n. So, well, we're almost done here. We get that the partial derivative, if I keep all the terms straight, I get plus kappa squared times xi alpha n alpha, which is minus 1, minus kappa squared xi alpha n alpha, which is minus 1, and sure enough, I get 0. So, well, this is the formal proof that kappa differentiated along v is 0. But again, there's nothing surprising about this, because this is the derivative of kappa along the Killing symmetry. And it would have been very surprising to see something non-zero coming out of this, given that everything satisfies the Killing symmetry. Any motion along xi will not produce any change to the geometrical properties of the horizon. All right, so nothing too mysterious about that. Anyway, so to prove it formally mathematically, I needed to do a few steps of algebra. But all of that follows very simply. One property that we had to invoke here is the relationship between this and the Riemann tensor that's true for any killing vector. Okay, well, we've done it along, so this is the derivative along the generators. Now we need to work on the derivative across generators. So we're going to go through some of that calculation again, but now we're going to take, you know, the vector here to be E and not C, and we're going to see that, well, we're going to have to do a little bit more work along those lines to prove the result. So let's get going with that. Okay, I think I can get rid of this. Okay, so now we want to say something about the derivative of kappa across generators, which is the derivative of kappa in the direction of the transverse vectors. And we have two transverse directions. And, well, a lot of the calculation just proceeds along the same lines. Everything inside the bracket here, you know, can be written unchanged. The only thing that needs to change is the vector that I tag on the end of this. And what that means is that I can just copy this line and just make the, you know, the appropriate replacement of C by E. So let's do that. I'll save myself a couple of steps. And what I have here is the Riemann tensor term that here will multiply Xi nu, multiply N, multiplies Xi, and multiplies a mu, e mu. So we have that term. Then we have the other term, which I can immediately write as kappa xi alpha that multiplies n mu, n a differentiated with respect to mu in the direction of e. So we have that term. And then the final term is xi alpha beta n alpha, and then xi beta differentiated with respect to mu in the direction of E. So that's what I need to work with. Let's see, I think I, yeah, there should have been minus sign here. I think that sign will be important. Okay, so I think I'll just rewrite this, and here I'll do the same trick on this derivative acting on n. I'll just transfer the derivative over to xi using the fact that the inner product between the two is equal to a constant. So in the end, I have minus r. Let's see, I want to follow my notes here. So I think I'll do some relabeling of dummy indices. I have mu nu alpha beta e mu a xi nu and alpha xi beta. Right, so I've just changed the position of the indices here on the Riemann tensor. Over here, I have plus kappa. I have n alpha that multiplies xi alpha differentiated in the direction of mu times e mu. And from over here, I get minus n alpha, xi alpha from beta, and xi beta from mu times E. Okay, so it's just exactly the same equation with a couple of little changes. Okay, so we're going to have to work on the Riemann tensor in just a little while. But you see that this combination here occurs in two terms. But that's something that we actually can relate to what we had before. If I take the E, you know, if I evaluate this derivative in the E direction, I get nothing from over here. I get something from here, and I get nothing from there. So this derivative gives me CB times sigma AB. Because you know, here I'm just relabeling the dummy index to be a B. So I'm summing over the repeated B index over here. I have, so I'm multiplying by E mu A, which produces the inner product between EA and EB. That gives me sigma AB, and what's left over then is going to be XC beta. So, well, if you followed that, good. If you didn't, you can do it yourself on the side of the page. It's not very difficult. So what I'll do is to use the two-dimensional metric to lower the index on C. So I'll just re-express this as CA CB. So that can be used for simplification. So we have that over here. We have this over here. And with that, well, you see that this will combine with C over here to produce another kappa. We have N alpha C alpha over here that produces a minus one. And we should see that the two extra terms actually cancel out. So we get all of this. And from that, we get minus CA kappa. And that's it. And from over there, we get minus CA. We get this times that, giving us a kappa C. And we get an N. And this gives us another minus 1. So this cancels that. And the derivative that we're working on then is just given purely in terms of the Riemann tensor. OK, so a little bit of calculation led us to this first step, which has this derivative, which is supposed to be 0, expressed in terms of some components to the Riemann tensor. And now the hard part of the derivation is to prove that the right-hand side is actually 0. So any questions about what happened? Good? OK. All right. So I'm trying to decide how much of this I want to actually go through. OK, anyway, I'll go through some of that. I need to come up with a way of simplifying this. And what I'll do is to use the completeness relations that we have over here to try and do that. So the completeness relation, I'll write it in terms of nu and alpha. And the inverse metric evaluated on the event horizon is minus C alpha minus C nu N alpha minus N nu C alpha plus sigma AB E nu A E. I want to avoid AB here. I'll use B and C. So those are the completeness relations. And what I'm going to do is to replace this by this guy over here and just express it in terms of the metric and the rest of the vectorial directions. So what I really want to do here is to say that C, nu, and alpha is going to be expressed in terms of the metric with a minus sign, minus the rest of it. So what does that give us? Well, let's just write it down. That's going to be give us, well, the first thing that I get is minus the Riemann tensor contracted with the metric, and I'm contracting the second and third indices, which is like contracting the first and third indices, except for a minus sign, and that gives me the Ricci tensor. So the first term, and working out all of the minus signs, I have two over here, but I have another one here because of the choice of indices, just give me minus the Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor now, which is contracted in the direction of E, A, and C, B. So I've lost those vectors over here, but I retain the last two, the other two. And then I have the rest of it, but for the other term right here, notice that I have a xi alpha that will combine with a xi beta up here that produces something symmetric in alpha and beta, but the Riemann tensor is antisymmetric, so that gives no contribution. And what's left over is the stuff that involves all the E vectors. And let's see, with the minus sign, I get the Riemann tensor. With E mu A, I get E nu B, I get E alpha C, and finally Xi beta. And that's my new expression for the derivative of kappa moving along across generators. I'm missing the sigma, right. So it's over here. Okay. Well, we've made some progress. We need to keep pushing a little bit more. I think the part of the calculation that I'll skip, but I'll just sketch it, is to actually prove that all of that is zero. And the way to prove this is to, so let's leave this alone for the time being. Let's recall that the purely transverse components of the gradient of the tangent vector field are all zero. So that's the statement that comes with the fact that the expansion shear and rotation tensors all vanish. So we have that. We have that everywhere on the event horizon, which means that the statement is going to be true everywhere on the null hypersurface, which means that this is a statement that I can differentiate in all of the tangential directions, including the direction of xi, including the transverse directions. So having this, we know that we also have the statement that this differentiated in the transverse directions. Vanishes. And here there's a few lines of algebra that follow, but essentially the strategy is to expand all the derivatives. You end up with two derivatives of the Killing vector field, and you relate that to the Riemann tensor. And you work through the rest of it, then you use all of the symmetries and all of the all of the stuff that that's already been worked out. And what that turns into, and I'll skip those steps, is the statement that this condition guarantees that those components of the Riemann tensor vanish. So what we have as a consequence of this equation and the relationship between the derivative, you know, the relationship, so as a consequence of this equation and relating the second derivative of the Killing vector to the Riemann tensor, when you work it all out, what you find is that, well, those components of the Riemann tensor must vanish for all the conditions on the stationary horizon to be valid. So the spacetime must be such that those components of the Riemann tensor all vanish. Otherwise, there would be a contradiction between everything that we've said so far and that. And the bottom line is that this second term actually is zero. And the only thing that we're left with is something involving the Ricci tensor. You have a question?
Can we obtain the lambda?
Let's see. So the Bianchi identities would involve derivatives of the Riemann tensor. So I'm not sure.
How we have three indices.
The cyclic permutation.
Oh, the cyclic identity.
Yeah.
Maybe. Try it.
Because we have three. We have two crossing bases.
Yeah, it could be. I have a suspicion that maybe it's not quite enough, because that would guarantee that it's an identity for in all cases, and I'm pretty sure that you need the stationary condition in the statement. So at least according to what I remember reading about all this, I think it's a non-trivial result that doesn't quite, you know, that doesn't just follow as an identity, but, you know, maybe you're right and it's worth, you know, giving it a try. Question? No, because those are two different vectors, right? So those could be different vectors. If they're the same vector, of course, you're right. But they are, in principle, two different vectors. And that's right. So here you're forcing the symmetry in B and C, but that doesn't, that doesn't matter here. So it's a rather non-trivial result to get to that. But anyway, I think I prefer to, I mean, it's really very straightforward. You just work it through. You use some of that stuff that we have over here. You combine it all together, and, you know, that's the conclusion. It just takes a little bit of algebra to go through that, but, you know, it's not difficult. I just prefer to skip it here because I want to, I want to finish on time. Okay, well, now we're really getting close. And what we have at this stage is that, we have that the partial derivative that we're hoping to find is zero is actually related to a component of the Ricci tensor. And I'm going to use the field equations to relate that to a component of the energy momentum tensor. And, the Einstein field equation tells me that this is equal to T alpha beta minus a trace term. But the trace term we don't care about because those two vectors are orthogonal to each other. So after using the field equations, I get that this is minus 8 pi T alpha beta E alpha A C beta. And this I'll just rewrite as 8 pi J alpha J alpha E alpha A, where J alpha is minus T alpha beta C beta. And while it just turns out to be convenient to introduce this vector, But this vector has the interpretation of describing the flux of momentum across the event horizon. Okay, so now we're quite close. And what I need to do now is to produce an argument that this should be zero, that the angular components, the transverse components of the momentum vector should be zero. Well, let's see. We know that some components of the energy momentum tensor have to be zero by the argument that I gave you this morning. If we have a stationary horizon such that this is zero, this is zero, this is zero, this is zero, then this all by itself has to be zero, which means that we have a pretty tight constraint right here on the components of the energy momentum tensor. So importing this condition right here, that has to be zero, and what that means is that the C component of J has to be zero. And decomposing J into the vectorial basis means that J can have a component along C, and it can have a component along E, but it cannot have a component along N because that would be incompatible with that condition right here. So the most general form for J has to be this, given the constraint that we have here. And what I'm going to have to do here is to invoke another energy condition to finally wrap the argument, wrap up the argument. Because at this stage, you know, if I want to conclude that the angular component of J have to be zero, I have to kill that term, and I don't have yet an argument, I don't have a reason to kill off that term. So I need an argument, and I need an extra reason in order to kill that term, and that extra reason is going to be an additional energy condition, which is not the null energy condition that's already been used. The null energy condition tells us that J has to have this expression. The null energy condition is not enough to kill that term, and if I don't kill that term, then the right-hand side is not zero.
Can I just make a remark?
Yep.
Did you actually need the null energy condition before? Because given that the shear vanishes by itself.
If I make this and this equal to zero, then the sum of those two things have to be zero.
But the shear vanishes because of the killing equation.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. Yes. Oh, okay. So if you have the shear free condition directly from the killing equation, which I conceded we do, then this vanishes without having to invoke any energy condition here. I'm going to have to rewrite my book because, you know, every time I find new errors. So very good point. So far I haven't used any energy condition, but now I'm going to have to. So I can conclude that this is zero without invoking an energy condition. But now we're still stuck at that point, and I'm going to invoke the dominant energy condition to kill off that term. So the final step in the argument is to say that the dominant energy condition which says that the dominant energy condition says that the momentum vector has to be time-like. Must be time-like or null. And basically, the bottom line is that we require the length of that vector to be either zero or negative. And basically what happens is that you can turn a null vector into a space-like vector by adding a space-like vector to it. What you cannot do is to turn a null vector into a time-like vector by adding a space-like vector to it. So if you want this, Well, essentially, you have to kill that term, because otherwise it would turn this vector, you know, this combination here wouldn't necessarily be a space-like vector. So a null direction plus a space-like direction is space-like. And if we want to avoid this, which is what the dominant energy condition asks us to do, then what we have to say is that there cannot be a piece like this, because I'll never be able to make that vector time-like unless B is zero, in which case the vector is automatically null. So the requirement that J alpha must be time-like or null implies that B is equal to zero. If you don't believe my argument here, just calculate the length of this. Use the fact that C is orthogonal to itself, that C is orthogonal to E. And what you find is that the length of J is, in fact, the length is B squared. So the length, I can just write it. J alpha is equal to BABB sigma AB by direct calculation. And this is guaranteed to be positive unless B itself is zero. And that's what I'm saying here. Once we have that, so invoking the dominant energy condition, we have that J alpha is a null vector. And if we go back to our equation, well, we find that J alpha has to be orthogonal to E, and we're done. This then guarantees that the partial derivative of the surface gravity across generators is zero. You impose it.
But you expect K to vary with theta. I beg your pardon.
You expect not to?
No. You were saying before that because the null energies, the event horizon is not spherical symmetric.
Right.
You expect K to vary with
the polar angle.
Polar angle.
Right.
Is this denying it?
Yeah.
But you're just making it so.
Okay. So I'll say a little bit more about this, but okay, so fact number one is that if you look at the surface gravity of the Kerr black hole, you find that it does not depend on theta, and that's a surprise because, you know, the deformation of the event horizon would have suggested that that it should depend on theta. Here's an attempt to prove that the result is far more general than just for the Kerr metric, but the proof relies on two things. It relies on the field equations, and it relies on imposing the dominant energy condition, which is not very surprising because virtually any result that has been proved for black holes, like the second law that I'll talk about in a moment, singularity theorems, like lots of stuff, they all rely on some form of energy condition. And back in the 70s and still today, people don't expect macroscopic matter fields to violate any of those energy conditions, except perhaps for the strong one, which is a little bit too strong for anyone's good. So to have to impose the null energy, the dominant energy condition, is not such a severe restriction. It certainly, you know, is physically plausible that a flow of momentum should proceed along time-like or null directions, not along space-like directions. That's what the dominant energy condition says. So am I making it so? Well, it's still a rather powerful result that, you know, based on a rather mild assumption and all the calculation, that that you do get it out. This was the original proof of the zero flaw. So now we've proved each component of you know, each statement of the law, and we do have a proof that kappa is going to be uniform on the event horizon. That was the original proof that was due to Bardeen, Hawking, and Carter. And it always struck me as being a little bit more contrived than, well, not contrived, but more difficult than probably it needs to be. And in particular, this reliance on the field equations and on the dominant energy condition is something that, I always felt was probably unnecessary. Other proofs have been produced since the original proof, and there's one due to Rax and Wald, I think that goes back to the late 90s, which in fact is very different and in fact holds regardless of the field equations and regardless of energy conditions. It's a proof that is based entirely on the assumption of having a stationary horizon. There's another proof that's pretty old. I don't know who came up with it. That is the proof that I actually give you in the text of my book. And that proof is actually extremely clever. And it goes as follows. It can be based directly on this equation right here. We know that motion along the generators is a Killing symmetry. So this quantity right here is guaranteed to be constant as you move along generators. And the point is that if this derivative is zero along any point on the generator of the event horizon, it's going to be true. It's going to be zero along all points on a given generator. So if you can find a place on the event horizon where this is zero, you know, at one value of V, then it's going to be true for all values of V because moving along V is a Killing symmetry. So that's statement number one. Statement number two is that, well, on the bifurcation two sphere, the Killing vector is zero. On the bifurcation two sphere, xi is equal to zero. Therefore, the right-hand side to that equation is zero on the bifurcation two sphere. And I just said that as I move away from that special spot on the horizon, as I move into the v direction, I'm not going to change that zero value to a non-zero value. And therefore, that's the statement that the left-hand side is to be zero anywhere along any generator. And that's a proof. Well, some people like it, some people don't like it. What I find is a little bit unfortunate about this version of the proof is that it does rely on the existence of a bifurcation two sphere, which you don't have if you have a black hole that's formed by gravitational collapse. In the book, I have an argument around this, but now it becomes a little bit hand-wavy and, you know, a little bit less satisfactory. So I think, there are various ways of looking at this result, but regardless, in the end, you have a proof that the surface gravity is uniform on the event horizon, and that's the statement of the zero law. It's called that, of course, because that's entirely analogous to the statement in thermodynamics that says that if you have a thermodynamic system in equilibrium, its temperature is going to be uniform. Here we have a black hole in equilibrium, a stationary black hole. The surface gravity is uniform. Okay, let me move on to the first law, and that actually turns out to be pretty painless. Yep.
Do you mind if I just ask one question? In the Raichu-Dury equation, could you just tell me, remind me? I can see why theta dV is zero. Why is theta zero again?
Theta is the rate of expansion. So if the horizon is stationary, the congruence is not expanding nor contracting, and that means that theta has to be zero. If that's not obvious, you can look at this equation right here. So what I'm saying is that the cross-sectional areas on a stationary horizon will stay constant forever. That's what it means for the horizon to be stationary. Therefore, the cross-sectional areas will not change as you move along the generators. That means that the right-hand side here is zero. Right. So it's essentially a definition of what it means to have a stationary horizon. Okay, I'm pressed with time because I need to go back to Guelph for a final exam tonight, and I'll need to leave pretty sharply, not too far from 5:30, so I'm afraid I'll have to rush through the rest of the lecture. So I want to do the first law. And the first law is a statement that during a quasi-static process, and a quasi-static process here has the same meaning as it does in thermodynamics. You go through a succession of equilibrium states from one black hole, one stationary black hole state to a final stationary black hole state, and you do it slowly enough so that you don't perturb the equilibrium or the stationary, successive states. You don't introduce a lot of rapid dynamical changes into the space-time. And the statement is that during such a process, you will change the mass of the black hole, you will change its area, and you will change its angular momentum. And there's a relationship among all of those things, which is this one right here. So a change in mass is connected to a change in area and a change of angular momentum. So one way of understanding this is to say, well, let's see what happens when you compare two Kerr black hole solutions. One with, so the Kerr solution depends, has two independent parameters, M and J. And everything else about the black hole can be worked out as a function of M and J, including the area. So the area is a function of of M and J. And if you change M and J during a quasi-static process that takes a Kerr black hole into another Kerr black hole, then of course the area has to change in a way that's compatible with the functional relationship between A and M and J, and the changes are, happen to be connected through this equation right here. So the simplest way of obtaining this is really to do this. You just look at the area relationship for a Kerr black hole in terms of M and J, and then you just change M and J, and you see what change in the area you produce, and you get exactly this formula. But there's a way of making the formula, the statement of the first law, more general than this. It doesn't have to be Kerr black holes. All we care about here is that they be, that there be two stationary black holes, one initially, one finally, and that we have a quasi-static process that takes us from one to the other. And the way to prove this is actually quite simple. So what we're going to think of here is a quasi-static process, which is actually produced by sending matter across the event horizon. And the matter is going to be, described in terms of an energy momentum tensor, which we're going to think of here as an infinitesimal energy momentum tensor. So we have an infinitesimal energy momentum tensor that represents the flow of matter across the event horizon. It's because we have that matter crossing the event horizon that we have a change of mass and angular momentum. And a while back, we worked out an expression for the amount of mass transfer that takes place when you send matter through a hypersurface. So a change in so if we have matter flowing through a hypersurface, in other words, if we have matter flowing across the event horizon, we know that the mass that will transfer across the event horizon is going to be, there's going to be a minus sign, but it's going to be essentially the component of the energy momentum tensor along the Killing direction integrated over the event horizon. So that's something that we described before. That's the transfer of mass across the event horizon, and we have a similar formula that describes the transfer of angular momentum across the event horizon. And that is also an integral over a component of the energy momentum tensor, but here we're talking about the phi component to the energy momentum tensor. So that's something which we reviewed before. What I'm going to do is to take dm minus omega h dj, and I'm going to express that in terms of an integral over the event horizon. And I'm going to get an overall minus sign, and I'm going to get t alpha beta that multiplies t beta plus omega h phi beta. And this is what we integrate. Inside the bracket, we recognize this as our Killing vector on the event horizon. The surface element is this. And what we get then is that dm minus omega h dj is equal to an integral over the event horizon of t alpha beta, c alpha, c beta, integrated over the cross-sectional areas and then integrated along the generators. All right, well, what do we do with that? Well, I have Rachel Dury's equation that involves precisely that component to the energy momentum tensor. What we have here is a horizon which is no longer strictly stationary because I am sending matter through the event horizon, and that will cause the event horizon to actually grow in size. And the way to describe this mathematically is through the Rachel Dury equation. We have an expansion of the generators up until the time where, you know, up through the time we're sending matter across the event horizon. The generators increase in, expand, the horizon will increase in area just as long as I continue to send matter across. And as soon as I stop doing that, the generators will become stationary. The inflowing matter will have focused the generators just enough so that at the end of the process, the generators will become stationary again. So physically speaking, during the slow process, we have a horizon which is no longer stationary. And what that means is that, well, theta is no longer going to be zero. It's going to be small, but it's not going to be zero. If this is an infinitesimal energy momentum tensor, it's going to generate changes in theta that will also be small. And in Rachel Dury's equation, well, if I'm going to be working to first order in T alpha beta, and I'm going to be working to first order in theta, I'm allowed to actually neglect the quadratic term over here, and I'm also allowed to neglect the quadratic term in the shear tensor. That would be also a second order perturbation. So to first order, what we find is that, well, the component to the energy momentum tensor that appears inside the integral is actually equal to, there's a factor of 1 over 8 pi, but it's actually equal to, I'm sending this to the other side, kappa theta minus d theta dv. Yep. So what do we have? We have that the changes that we have on the left-hand side become 1 over 8 pi. And I'm going to get two integrals. In the first integral, kappa can be pulled out of the integral because we've just established that kappa is a constant along the integral. So we have kappa. And then we have the integral over the entire event horizon of theta times ds dv. And then we get minus 1 over 8 pi. We have an integral over the entire event horizon of d theta dv ds dv. Well, the second integral I can do easily because here I'm differentiating with respect to v and then I'm integrating with respect to v. So basically what will happen here is that I'm going to get the integrated expansion over the surface of the event horizon at v equals infinity and v minus infinity, or whatever the two limits are that correspond to, you know, the starting of the process and the ending of the quasi-static process. And the point here is that, well, because I start with a stationary state and I end up with a stationary state, you know, the expansion is going to be zero at the start of the process and it's going to be zero again at the end of the process. So the integral actually, the second integral actually doesn't contribute anything. So we can forget about that one. That's a pure boundary term which vanishes. That one over here, well, theta ds, according to the result we have over here, is dv, is ddv of ds. So again, I have something that corresponds to a derivative that we next integrate. And what we have then, according to that term, is kappa over 8 pi times, again, a boundary term. But now the boundary term is a little bit different. it's going to be the integral over the horizon of ds evaluated at the two limiting points. So we have the area after minus the area before. That's the change in area. The integral over the horizon of ds, you know, at the two boundary points is going to be the area integral after the process minus the area integral before the process. And basically, we're done. So what comes out in the end is precisely that statement right here. Dm minus omega h dj is kappa over 8 pi times the change in area during the quasi-static process. And that's a neat little proof of the first law that follows, you know, for all, you know, quasi-stationary black holes that have the Killing symmetry, that in the unperturbed state has the Killing symmetry. The proof is very, very simple, uses, you know, deep, rather advanced geometrical ideas, because you have to understand what the Reicher-Dury equation means, you have to understand what the expansion means in physical terms and all of that stuff. So you need some baggage to be able to absorb this this derivation, but you have it thanks to discourse. And basically you can prove the result in just a few lines. If you wanted to prove this using the Kerr metric, you would have to work pretty hard at expressing the area in terms of J and M and taking all the derivatives, all the partial derivatives and all of that stuff. It would generate much messier algebra than what's required here. So I really like this this proof right there. All right, second law. Well, you know about the second law. It's the famous one. Well, that one is really easy to prove. Well, at least if you don't worry too much about technicalities and fine print and things like that. If you read Hawking and Ellis, of course, all of that is fully specified, and you know, it's a bit of a mess. But the idea is very simple. The area of the horizon will always grow, unless, or well, not necessarily. It's not. It's the, you know, if you have a stationary black hole, the area remains constant. But in during any physical process that affects the black hole, the area will never decrease. It can only increase or stay constant. Well, why is that? Well, the answer is very simple. We have our horizon, and we have our congruence of null generators, and we know all about the fact that there cannot be future caustics developing on the event horizon. That's forbidden. What if you had a piece of the event horizon where theta would be negative? If you had that, that would mean that locally the area is attempting to decrease a little bit. But if you had that, the focusing theorem would guarantee that those GdxX over here would actually turn into a caustic. Remember the focusing theorem. If you as a result of Reicher-Dury's equation, if theta starts negative, theta will become increasingly negative, and you will form a caustic in finite affine parameters at that time. So if there's any local piece of the event horizon where theta is negative, that is any local piece to the horizon that tends to, that would tend to produce an area decrease, what you would find is that, well, this piece of the event horizon would develop into a caustic, and that would violate the very, very definition of an event horizon. This would be a future endpoint to the null congruence of to the congruence of null generators, and that would generate the possibility of sending a signal to infinity. After all, you know, that would mean that you can escape from the event horizon, which you cannot if the event horizon is a true event horizon and a causal boundary. So the point is that, you know, there just cannot be any place on the event horizon where theta is negative. And what that means is that if this cannot happen, the only thing that can happen is either that theta is positive, which is fine, or that theta is positive, a zero or positive, and all of that is fine. And during any physical process that involves, any dynamical process that involves a black hole, the horizon will always expand to make sure that at the end of the process, the generators have finished with their expansion and have turned into stationary generators. So anywhere on the event horizon, the expansion of the null generators is guaranteed to be non-negative, which means that after integrating over each cross-section of the event horizon, the area will be forced to increase. It's even better than that, because if new generators enter the horizon, this will contribute even further to the growth of the integrated area. So no matter what you do, the area cannot decrease. That's just incompatible with the very idea of an event horizon. So there's no avoiding the conclusion that the area of the event horizon has to increase or cannot decrease at any time. I think the idea is very simple. The fine print are, there are lots to be taken care of, but there's really, I think the ideas are very simple to understand, and it's essentially based on the focusing theorem, and the focusing theorem in this case relies on the null energy condition. So here you need to invoke the null energy condition to make this work. So part of the fine print is a requirement that whatever goes across the event horizon has to satisfy the null energy condition. So that's Hawking's famous theorem. And of course, when you take the two of them together, the three of them together, you have a rather deep and puzzling analogy between thermodynamics and the laws of black hole mechanics. The rest of the story, I think, is familiar. Hawking realized that, black holes had a temperature after all, a temperature that is proportional to the surface gravity. And through this equation right here, conclude that the area has to be analogous to entropy, and you can fix the proportionality constant between area and entropy by fixing the constant between temperature and surface gravity. And, all of that is pretty well known and famous. And we had a nice talk this morning about what this means in terms of information loss and puzzles and paradoxes and things like that. Well, the final law of black hole mechanics is the statement that if you start with a black hole, you cannot turn it into a naked singularity. More precisely stated, you cannot turn a non-extreme black hole into an extreme black hole, in a continuous process over a finite time. That's analogous to the statement of the third law in ordinary thermodynamics. So that's something that also can be proved, that also involves some of the energy conditions. And I have an illustration of that in the book, not a proof, but just an illustration of the theorem. And we have a really good package here of laws of black hole mechanics, which are very tight and based on differential geometry, based on general relativity, based on some energy conditions, but all laws that can be proved without any obstacle. And there's something to be said about the difference between the second law of thermodynamics and the second law of black hole mechanics. The second law of thermodynamics cannot be proved. It has no proof based on underlying microphysics. This law is proved in general relativity. So there's a distinction there that's sort of interesting.
What would happen if you tried to create a one-to-one correspondence between thermodynamics and general relativity and work backwards to get proof for it?
Well, I think, people certainly do that. So now the bonded view of this is that, the black hole area is its measure of entropy. And in any thermodynamic process that involves a black hole, you have the generalized second law of thermodynamics that says that all forms of entropy, including black hole entropy, increase during a process. The problem is that, you can prove that the black hole entropy by itself would increase, but you still cannot prove that the typical matter entropy, the traditional matter entropy, has to increase all by itself by virtue of microphysics. So you have a proof of this law of black hole mechanics. You don't have a proof of the second law of black hole, the generalized second law of thermodynamics, including black holes.
So I'm wondering, obviously this second law comes because you have some additional axiom at the beginning that makes this proof happen. I wonder what would happen if you looked at thermodynamics and said, what's a corresponding axiom that doesn't exist in thermodynamics?
Yeah, but it's an interesting question, and certainly a lot of people have tried to come to produce a proof of the second law over the years. It's really something that you have trouble with when the laws of physics are time reversal invariant. And here you're producing a statement that breaks, obviously the time reversal invariance. In the black hole case, I think we have an understanding of this as we discussed this morning. You break time reversal invariance by introducing the very notion of an event horizon. So that's why we have a proof here. But with time reversal invariant microphysics, there's no way you can really prove the second law unless you say something about the nature of the initial conditions and things like that, which is probably the resolution to that problem. You have a question?
Yeah. Do you reconcile the cost of the future caustic picture with, say, it's
Ah, well, okay. So that's typically the question that comes next. Doesn't Hawking radiation violate this? And of course, the answer is yes. When the black hole is evaporating, it's actually shrinking. And that means that the second law is actually invalidated by the Hawking process. Why does that happen? Well, it happens because the Hawking radiation violates the null energy condition that's involved in proving the second law. So you don't have a theorem in that case because the premise of the theorem is broken. What happens to the end process? So certainly if you include black hole evaporation, you destroy the very idea of an event horizon to begin with, because in the final evaporation stage, everything disappears, including the event horizon. So certainly that's a place where whatever you call the event horizon has a future endpoint. In fact, it's a rather dramatic future endpoint of the whole evaporation process. So of course, I was here formulating a classical theory of black holes. If you want to accommodate the quantum effects, which of course you need to, then you have to revise those notions. But then it becomes very hard to make them precise anymore. So you have to, you have to give up on a lot of these things.
Would it also
No, so you don't have to change the Rayleigh-Schrödinger equation. The only thing that what changes is that the focusing theorem is no longer guaranteed because you cannot control the sign of this. So you can still come up with a semi-classical description of the evaporation process, where this is treated as a sort of classical field. It would be a sort of semi-classical field corresponding to Hawking radiation, but it would correspond to a flux of negative energy across the event horizon, and it would just violate the premise of the focusing theorem, and therefore, violate the statement of the second law. What is understood today is the fact that if you now think in terms of the generalized second law, and you account for all the entropy in the Hawking radiation together with the black hole entropy, then the sum of the entropies will still increase during black hole evaporation. So you're not violating the generalized second law, you're just violating the second law of black hole mechanics. But we're not surprised by that. It's pretty common for open systems to have one part of the system decreasing its entropy while the overall system increases its entropy. So that's what happens. Harvey?
Just a remark about the analogy with classical thermodynamics. Some people refer to the minus first law of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Something so fundamental that it really deserves the name of the law, and it's the origin of the time asymmetry.
Right.
And that's the claim that a system will spontaneously approach equilibrium, and once it gets there, never leave.
Right.
And that's exactly analogous, as far as I can see, to the no future caustics. If you have a caustic and you leave it, you never get back to it.
True.
That's a fundamental introduction.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Yep. Well, I'm sort of sorry that I had to rush through this final lecture, and it was I'll answer your question. I just wanted to say that I regret the fact that I had to leave so soon. It would have been nice to talk a little bit more and have a little bit more time to discuss these things. Pacing of an entire course is hard to predict. But I really had fun this time around. I think you were a great group to be in front of, and I really enjoyed myself. I hope you did too. And we'll see each other again on the day of the presentations. But thank you for, you know, being with me for the entire semester. So you had a question?
Oh, no. I'm kind of hungry that some library might form a closet, but the information, like the library, will not really cut out the email, right? Just from a closet in certain direction, right?
I don't know the answer to that. And I think the point is that I think it would be very hard to produce a caustic that would be so well controlled that you would be able to rule out, a leaking off from the event horizon. And I think that's the point. Once you're dealing with caustics, you're dealing with the singularity of the congruence. And it would have to be a rather extremely mild form of a singularity that would allow for a unique extension beyond it. And the problem is that you cannot guarantee that it's going to be so mild. You're really losing your ability to predict what happens on the other side of the caustic. And that's why you can't really tolerate caustics in the future history of the generators. Yep?
The mass and the angular momentum are defined at syntonic infinity, but how do you know the variation of mass and angular momentum
right here? I was a little bit I didn't want to spell out all of those subtleties, but there are huge subtleties involved here. I was talking about the transfer of mass and angular momentum across a hypersurface created by a test energy momentum tensor, and that's what, you know, this particular version of the proof refers to, those changes of, you know, those transfers of mass and angular momentum. If I wanted to prove that this really does correspond to a change of mass and area, while area is easier to see, but if I wanted to prove that this really corresponds to a change in the black hole mass and angular momentum, I would have to do a little bit more work, and I would have to think about what happens. So if I'm defining the mass with respect to what happens at infinity, I would have to make sure that I understand what happens between the black hole and infinity. And some care needs to be applied there. I like this version of it because it's the most immediate, the easiest to go through. If it were the only proof, I would say it's not good enough because the issue that you raise is not, cannot be answered on the basis of this proof. But it turns out that you can do different things. You can look at this from different points of view, and every time you get exactly the same result, and that means that, well, in the end, it all works out. But you're right, here it was certainly not very obvious, and you're right to point it out. Okay, well, I really must go, so I'll see you on the 21st.